Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. My co-host Ahmed and I are very happy and pleased and grateful to the amazing support that you all showed to WMNF and to True Talk. We received so many amazing words of encouragement and beautiful messages, and so many listeners sent to us telling us how important True Talk is and how valuable the information that Ahmed and I offer is for you. Thank you so much for your support, and as I always say, this is one of the most unique opportunities that we have in America that does not exist in most of the Arab world, if not all the Arab world. The people there cannot have a listener-supported radio station where there is editorial freedom, where we can criticize the president of this powerful nation, as well as other presidents and leaders of the Arab world and the Muslim world. We talk about so many different issues, as you see, without any sort of censorship. So this is an amazing service that we offer, and Ahmed and I are absolutely grateful. I want to start this show by playing a song called My Name is Palestine. Actually, it was sent to me by one of the listeners. I never heard of the song or the singer. The singer is Garth Hewitt. He is British, and I think he is a son of an Anglican reverend. His father is Thomas Hewitt, and I think also the son, I'm not sure if he is if he is a priest or anything, but he is known as a Christian singer in England. One of the interesting things about him, when I was Googling him to know more about him, is that he became interested in social justice issues when he was very young. And he listened to a sermon or a lecture by Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King was a guest preacher at London's St. Paul's Cathedral. King was on his way to Oslo, Norway, to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, and that event in particular attracted more than 4,000 people. And Hewitt was listening, and he became aware of social justice issues. Then, when he was much older, around maybe 2006, he read a book by a Palestinian priest. His name is Elias Shakur, and the book, I think, is called Blood Brothers. And he started to become aware of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian issue. And he did have several songs about Palestine, Bethlehem, and, you know, he has a Christian background, so his songs tend to be quite religious. But this particular song, My Name is Palestine, and I'm quoting here why he did it. It was triggered by a painting that he saw. So let me quote here. He says he was in Bethlehem in a hotel, and where Banksy, the artist, has several paintings there. And one of the paintings that he was looking at was by an artist called Suleiman Mansour. And he thought that the painting was very powerful. And he wanted to write a song and do a song because of this painting. And he took permission of the painter, and he was granted permission to do a song. The words are, "My name is Palestine. A voice cries out in the wilderness. I hear her call, but I don't know her name. The voice cries again in the wilderness. My name is Palestine. I will remain. She's holding a flag so very high, raises her voice with such a strong cry. She's a symbol of a people who refuse to die. Says my name is Palestine. I will survive."
Don't know her name. Voice cries again in the wilderness. strong cry. She's a symbol of a people who refuse to die. Says, my name is Palestine and I will survive. I will survive, I will survive. My name is Palestine and I will survive. Of darkness can't extinguish the flame of the freedom in your eyes and the love you retain. These are more powerful than the weapons of war. With their terror and lies, but you bring something more. And all across Palestine they've had enough of killing and wounding from Israeli guns. Want no more occupation, no more siege, no more brutality, they just want peace. I will survive, I will survive. My name is Palestine and I will survive. I will remain, I will remain. My name is Palestine, I will remain.
Make a road in the desert.
A place they've tried to make disappear. It's a people they've tried to make you fear. But the welcome they give you always means Palestine gets under your skin.
I will survive, I will survive. My name is Palestine and I will survive.
Her voice with such a strong cry, a symbol of a people who refuse to die. She says, my name is Palestine and I will survive. My name is Palestine and I will survive.
Welcome back to True Talk. Let me remind our listeners that this is a taped show. If you have any comments, please send them to dj@wmnf.org. Last week, I conducted an interview with Omar Badar. He is based in Washington, D.C., and he is an expert on Middle East issues. He spoke about the United Arab Emirates peace initiative with the State of Israel. Listen to this interview. Good morning, Omar. Good to have you on True Talk today.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
Omar Badar is a political analyst. He is based in Washington, D.C., and he is a very, very well spokesperson for the Palestinian cause in the U.S. Omar, let me begin by playing a short clip by President Trump on the, what he calls a historic peace deal. Let's listen.
Just a few moments ago, I hosted a very special call with two friends, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, where they agreed to finalize a historical peace agreement. Everybody said this would be impossible. And as you know, Mohammed is one of the great leaders of the Middle East. After 49 years, Israel and the United Arab Emirates will fully normalize their diplomatic relations. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors and begin cooperation across the board and on a broad range of areas, including tourism, education, healthcare, trade, and security. This is a truly historic moment. Not since the Israel-Jordan peace treaty was signed more than 25 years ago has so much progress been made towards peace.
How historic is it, Omar?
In some ways it is unprecedented, but not in the way that Donald Trump is talking about. I think Donald Trump here is basically engaging in a cheap political stunt to try to shore up a foreign policy accomplishment after years of foreign policy failure. He was sure that he was going to get things sorted out with North Korea, and that didn't work. He tore up the Iran nuclear deal and was sure that he was going to be able to get the Iranians to sign a new deal that is more favorable to the United States and Israel, and that didn't work out. And then he presented the so-called deal of the century, and he was sure that he could squeeze the Palestinians into accepting it, and that did not work out for him. And on top of the mishandling of the pandemic here in the U.S., Trump is in a desperate search for something that he can point to as though it were an accomplishment. And he's counting on the general ignorance of the American population when it comes to foreign policy matters. He's acting as though this is a peace agreement between enemies when it's nothing of the sort. The alliance between the United Arab Emirates and Israel has been ongoing also since the 1990s at least, with all kinds of under-the-table cooperation on matters of security, on matters of intelligence, and even some diplomatic ties as well. And all this agreement did is shift an under-the-table relationship, alliance, into becoming more open. So by no stretch of the imagination is this a peace deal. It is a deal to normalize relations that have already been in existence. And it is significant only in its implications on Arab solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, because the Arab world had stuck to something called the Arab Peace Initiative, by which they committed to normalizing with Israel only if Israel withdraws from the occupied Palestinian territories, which are only 22% of historic Palestine, and agrees to solve the issue of Palestinian refugees in accordance with international law. And that was a major compromise from the Arab world towards Israel that was given with the acceptance of the Palestinian leadership as well. And Israel, of course, rejected that. They insisted on holding Palestinians as a captive population under the boot of occupation and apartheid, and just essentially threw away that Arab Peace Initiative and just tossed it in the garbage can. And so to see that an Arab government is willing to normalize with Israel, despite Israel's refusal to meet even the most minimal and symbolic gestures towards Palestinian human rights is in a sense unprecedented.
What's the reaction in the Arab world, Omar?
I think the reaction is broadly negative. I think as far as public opinion in the Arab world, there is significant solidarity with the issue of Palestine and with the Palestinian struggle for justice. That is ongoing. The priority of Palestine in Arab public opinion has diminished a little bit. It's no longer the single top issue when it comes to matters of foreign policy, as far as the Arab world is concerned, for understandable reasons, of course, because the past few years have been completely chaotic for the region. But it does not change the fact that, in general, the population of the Middle East still is in very deep solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, and they're not in favor of this kind of normalization. Of course, that's different for governments that often see the Palestinian struggle as a burden. They know that it's not popular to normalize with Israel, and so they're holding on to this idea that we need to resolve the Palestinian issue, and they're desperate to see it solved, just so that they can go on establishing the kinds of relationships that we just saw between the UAE and Israel, which are predicated on a common interest in containing Iranian influence in the region. That is ultimately what a lot of these Gulf states view as a priority, as a matter of policy, and Palestine really comes as a secondary issue for them. But that disconnect between governments and the people is reflected in the fact that these are autocratic governments that are not democratic. They do not represent the will of the people. And that's why that disconnect exists.
They're not only undemocratic and authoritarian, but they are engaged in wars in Yemen, for instance. They're starving the Yemeni people. They're killing them. They don't have any democratization, any representation. I mean, how could Israel, who brags about being the only democracy in the Middle East and in that part of the world, be very happy about putting its hand with such authoritarian regimes?
I mean, look, the entire, you know, charade about Israeli democracy, they understand very well that they don't have true democracy. It is democracy for a specific segment of the population, and it is military dictatorship for another segment of the population. It is exclusively a Jewish democracy that systematically discriminates against Palestinians. And in that sense, they know that this talk about Israeli democracy is just a PR stunt as well, for that matter. And so deep down, I think they prefer to keep the Arab world under dictatorships, because they know that having democracy throughout the Arab world would not serve Israel's interests, because Israel wants to keep expanding in the Palestinian territories. And if the Arab world is represented by democratic governments, then those governments are going to take a very different line when it comes to their relationships with Israel. They're going to be in meaningful solidarity with Palestinians as opposed to symbolic solidarity, which is what we're currently seeing. And that's, you know, for a lot of the, you know, there was a lot of talk about how this deal, in order to sell it to the Emirati and Arab public more broadly, was sold as a way to stop Israeli annexation in the West Bank. And mm-hmm. that also has been just a complete sham as well, because annexation is already a reality on the ground in Palestine. All Israel did is delay the mere announcement of that annexation. And the decision to delay that came as a result of international pressure, including from the United States, where Democratic politicians, Democratic Party politicians, for the first time ever, were talking about conditioning military aid to Israel if annexation moves forward. And that gave Netanyahu second thoughts about the wisdom of moving forward with declaring annexation. So they delayed it, but now they're pretending as though the delay is related to the Emirati deal, just as a way to save face with the settler population about why they have not moved forward with formal annexation yet. And on the Emirati side, I think it's also an attempt to save face about why they're normalizing with Israel, trying to twist it into some sort of win for Palestinians. But obviously, it's nothing of the kind.
This propaganda didn't last even for 24 hours, because Netanyahu came out and said, we are just suspending, where we will never stop annexation. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the Emirati government tries to square that circle, where they're, you know, they declared immediately after the deal that Israel has agreed to stop annexation, while Netanyahu is immediately talking about how annexation is not going to be really fully stopped, merely delayed. And you have Jared Kushner admitting as much as well. Pretty recently, he said Israel controls those territories anyway. So, you know, it's okay to hold off on that for the sake of, you know, building a better strategy in the region before they move forward. And what I suspect is happening is that Israel wants to wait to see if they can get Trump reelected. If Trump gets reelected, then I think Israel is going to feel much more confident moving forward with this annexation, because they will know that despite all the international pressure and condemnations and all of that, the most important government in the world is the United States, because it supplies Israel with nearly $4 billion in military aid every year and offers them unconditional diplomatic support at the UN. And if that government is willing to step up and defend annexation, then I think Israel will feel more confident doing it, knowing that for the next several years, the world superpower is going to have their back. I just want to backtrack to one point that you mentioned in relation to policy with, you know, a lot of these governments and their policy towards Yemen and so on. That is absolutely related to this decision as well, because when you think about it, it seems odd why the Emirati government would want to offer Donald Trump a political favor, which is what this is, to boost his re-election campaign, when what the UAE gets out of it is fairly limited. And the truth is, the UAE doesn't really benefit from making their relationship with Israel more public. It's primarily a PR loss in the Arab world as it currently stands. And the reason they did it is because they are invested in getting Donald Trump reelected as well. Donald Trump has been extremely lenient on a lot of these Gulf states as far as their human rights violations. He's much more hostile towards Iran, which is something a lot of these governments like. And that's what it's ultimately about. It's an attempt to strike a favor, because during the Obama administration, Obama struck a nuclear deal with Iran that made sure Iran could not develop nuclear weapons, but it did not restrain Iranian influence in the region to the extent that Israel and a lot of these Arab Gulf states wished it would. And they're afraid of a return of a Democratic Party to the executive in the White House, and what impact that might have in once again building pressure against these Gulf countries and building better relations with Iran, all of which both Israel and the Gulf
Let me remind our listeners that they are listening to Omar Badar, who is a political analyst, and he is based in the Middle East. Omar, he is based in Washington, D.C. You have mentioned annexation like 3-4 times. I'm not sure if our listeners are very aware of what it means, and you have done a wonderful, it's about 4 minutes, explanation of the meaning of annexation of the West Bank. Our patient Omar, I would like to play this segment.
Mm-hmm. The Israeli government is about to announce its plan to annex large parts of the West Bank. Here are three things you should know about this. Number one, annexation is land theft, pure and simple. The West Bank is Palestinian land that Israel has no claim to whatsoever. And Israel's takeover of the West Bank is categorically illegal under international law. Israel annexing parts of the West Bank is every bit as ridiculous as Israel taking parts of Italy or the United States and declaring them a part of Israel. The UN has issued a mountain of resolutions calling on Israel to withdraw from the territories it occupies, which include the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, citing the basic principle of international law that land cannot be acquired by force. The world was unanimous in condemning Israel's takeover of Palestinian lands until this guy came along and decided that land theft was okay with him. But every administration before him opposed Israel's theft of Palestinian land. Number two, annexation is part of an ethnic cleansing project. Wherever you may be in the world, don't just think of the Israeli government suddenly declaring that parts of your country are now Israel, but imagine the Israeli government sending its military into your neighborhood and evicting you and your family out of your home, either to demolish it or send Israeli settlers to take it over after throwing you out. How would you feel? This is precisely what Palestinians are experiencing under Israeli settler colonial expansion, despite objections from the UN and condemnations from human rights organizations and even harsh criticisms from US administrations. Israel continued to build more and more illegal settlements and continued to demolish the homes of Palestinians and drive them off of their land, all with the goal of ethnically cleansing indigenous Palestinians in order to achieve demographic dominance over the land. In some cases, Palestinians in East Jerusalem were literally thrown out of their homes by Israeli authorities so that Israeli Jewish settlers can come and take them over.
It's becoming a familiar scene in East Jerusalem. Jewish settlers taking over a Palestinian home and dumping the furniture in the garden.
This is the settlers' strategy. House by house, family by family, they're trying to take over the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. They're doing so with the full cooperation of the Israeli police and the Israeli courts. And it's a pattern that's repeating all over East Jerusalem.
And by the way, this ethnic cleansing did not start with the occupation. It started with Israel's creation in 1948, when more than 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes and hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages were destroyed. In fact, this ethnic cleansing continues even within Israel to this day. Number three, annexation settles the debate on the A word. For many years, the international community pushed Palestinians to swallow a bitter pill, to recognize Israel and settle for a state of their own on just 22% of historic Palestine. This is called the two-state solution. And in the 1980s, Palestinians swallowed that pill and made a massive compromise for peace, recognizing Israel with the understanding that Israel was going to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a small Palestinian state to exist. But Israel never lived up to its end of the bargain. It continued to swallow up whatever little was left of Palestine and drive Palestinians off of their land. And now with this annexation, Palestinians are completely encircled and controlled by Israel. So if Israel controls the lives of millions of Palestinians and denies them the right to vote for the government that controls their lives, how exactly is it a democracy? Let's ask former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
If the choice is one state, Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. It cannot be both. You would have millions of Palestinians permanently living in segregated enclaves in the middle of the West Bank with no real political rights, separate legal education and transportation systems, vast income disparities under a permanent military occupation that deprives them of the most basic freedoms. Separate and unequal is what you would have.
What's that word for applying separate and unequal sets of rights and privileges to two different ethnic groups under one government? Oh, that's right. That's apartheid. And it's a system of oppression that American taxpayers are funding with billions of dollars each year. During a time of pandemic and an unprecedented economic crisis with millions of Americans out of work, is supporting an oppressive foreign system of apartheid really the best use of our tax dollars?
Omar, this is fascinating, and I want to ask you about what the media has been talking about, the fact that other Gulf countries will join after United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia, like Bahrain, and even Sudan in Africa. What is the latest that's coming out of the Arab world? Has Saudi Arabia officially said something about this peace between Israel and the Emirates?
So far, Saudi Arabia is holding strong with the Arab peace initiative, insisting that there's not going to be normalization with relations until the issue of Palestine is solved. Now, of course, it's completely unclear how that is going to change moving forward. Netanyahu is promising that there will be multiple Arab governments who are going to be normalizing relations with Israel very soon. So I guess we'll have to wait and see which countries end up doing that. It's clear that countries are under tremendous pressure from Donald Trump to move forward in that direction. And I can understand their hesitance. Everybody's waiting to see how the countries that normalize relations are going to fare before they proceed in the same direction. I think there is an understanding that people throughout the region fully understand the justice of the Palestinian cause. They fully understand what Israeli occupation and apartheid mean in terms of denying Palestinians the most basic freedoms that everybody else enjoys. And there's not going to be enthusiasm for moving in that direction. And, you know, I think that there was always nervousness on the part of Arab governments to take things too far, as far as they're building those relations with Israel, out of fear of how the populations will react. Unfortunately, in a weird way, I think what once started as the Arab Spring and looked really promising at the end of 2010 and the beginning of 2011, and of course ended up being, making the region actually much worse in its final outcome because of counter-revolutionary forces that pushed back against democratic change in the Arab world, that there is a little bit of loss in the government's fear of their populations. There was always the fear of, what if the people rise up? What will we do? And how can we keep people from rising up? And then after people finally did rise up and they were crushed by these governments and things were restored, I feel like there's a bit of a loss of that factor of worrying about what the populations want. But you obviously can't push it too far as well. So I think that there's a bit of experimentation that is unfolding at this time to see what the, you know, quote unquote Arab street is going to react like. And I would not be surprised at all if more governments that, again, have absolutely no regard for, you know, the will of their populations, moving forward with what is politically convenient for them, as unfortunately has been the case for quite a while with a lot of these regional governments.
On the other side, Omar, there is a huge movement called BDS. And I feel that it is growing not only in Europe and the USA, but also in the Arab world, because several groups that identify with BDS in the Arab world, like from Kuwait, from Bahrain, from Qatar, and even from North Africa, they have all declared declarations and made statements that they are steadfast with supporting the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people, and that they will continue with BDS. Do you think it is really growing, or we are just being hopeful that this movement is really becoming more and more international and popular?
No, I think there's no question that the BDS movement is growing as a direct result of the failure of world governments to hold Israel accountable. I mean, with Israel, we're talking about the longest military occupation of modern history. It has been going on for well over 50 years at this point. You know, just internationally recognized illegal occupation that has to come to an end, and Israel refuses to end it. And the fact that nobody in the world is willing to step up and put meaningful pressure on Israel, apply sanctions, withhold aid, or any of that, has caused people, conscientious people who care about peace, justice, and human rights, to take matters into their own hands. And that is directly responsible for the amazing growth of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement throughout the entire world. And I think that includes the Arab world. Now, the only tricky part is that I think that there is a counter trend as well in parts of the Arab world where, you know, some state media throughout the Middle East is now trying to mainstream ideas of reconciliation with Israel and abandoning Palestinians. There's some anti-Palestinian sentiment that is now being shared on these channels. There is more room for anti-Palestinian sentiment to be expressed on social media. And it feels like there is a concerted effort to try to influence public opinion in an opposite direction. I guess we'll wait to see how that all plays out in the Middle East. I know that for the longest time, when I was growing up in the Middle East, and I've lived in several countries throughout the Arab world, public education about Palestine was fairly significant. There was this sense that you learned in school and watching television and so on, that the Palestinian cause is central to the Arab identity and Arab struggle. And it really is the prism through which people in the Arab world view international relations. It's so central. And with that effort to try to de-emphasize Palestine and abandon Palestinians, also expanding simultaneously as the BDS movement is growing, I suppose it remains to be seen how regional public opinion ends up falling at the end of what is sure to be a long public relations fight.
What is also changing, Omar, in the U.S. is the young generation. Even the Jewish American young generation, they seem to be more aware of the conflict and of Israel's inhumane and brutal treatment of the Palestinians. Do you see that there is a shift in the Democratic Party, but on the more progressive part or the younger generation, do you see any change?
Absolutely. And honestly, that's the most significant story of the day at the end of the day. It's so important to pay attention to this. Because look, I mean, the Republican Party in the United States has gone the way of Trump. Trump has become that party. And obviously nothing useful or helpful is going to come out of a Republican Party in its current formation. I think it's going to take many years for it to reform itself into something where there is a possibility for something positive to come. But on the Democratic side, there is really a seismic shift, you know. Historically, the Democratic Party is even more aligned with the Israel lobby is conventional wisdom. But we're beginning to see that change in a very, very significant way. And I think what you mentioned about sort of the increasing diversity in Jewish American public opinion is fairly significant. AIPAC used to pretend to speak for the entire American Jewish community, and that is obviously no longer the case. AIPAC, of course, is the most prominent Israel lobby group in the United States. And that is clearly no longer the case. You have now a centrist organization called J Street, which commands a fair bit of influence on Capitol Hill with members of Congress. And you have even more progressive organizations like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace. And it's showing a significant diversity within the Jewish community and significant support for Palestinian human rights and a desire to restrain Israel's worst impulses and behaviors. We can actually see that in public opinion as far as the Democratic Party is concerned. The majority of people in the Democratic base support applying sanctions or applying meaningful measures of accountability on Israel to get to stop building illegal settlements on Palestinian lands and to restrain Israel's human rights violations. And that is true not just of the Democratic base, but when you look just at the fact that this new generation in the United States that is far more diverse, we're talking about women and people of color, they have a much, much significantly different orientation when it comes to international politics. And it's being reflected with progressives increasingly getting elected in the Democratic Party, whether it's Palestinian American Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar or AOC. And now you have Jamal Bowman. You have a new generation of members of Congress who are really progressive and are willing to stand up for Palestinian rights. And the Israel lobby is not able to defeat them. They're spending millions of dollars on their opponents and they are failing. And that is the most significant part, is seeing that the power structures within the U.S. are beginning to shift and that there's this progressive movement that is insisting on support for Palestinian rights that is gaining momentum, and it's only a matter of time before they start having major influence on American policy.
And on the other side, we have people like Laura Loomer winning an election primary. Isn't it strange where the Republican Party is heading to elect somebody like Laura Loomer? And then the president has tweeted like 4 or 5 different tweets related to her. Do you know anything about Laura? I didn't mean to put you on the spot here, but this is something really surprising.
Yeah, no, I'm... Yeah, I'm familiar with the fact that she is a right-wing fanatic who engages in all kinds of hatred and conspiracy theories and all kinds of nonsense online. But frankly, it's not too surprising because that's the president that everything that I've just said about Loomer applies to Donald Trump himself. I mean, it's unfortunate what many years of right-wing talk radio like Rush Limbaugh and the Fox News machine have done to the American right and their public perceptions of the world. They've pushed them in a direction where people who are completely, you know, they're so easy to take advantage of that anybody who gets on television right now and engages in cheap racism or Islamophobia immediately gets, you know, elevated to national status. And that's really reflective of the level of ignorance that has spread on the American right as a result of these media machines. And it's an incredibly disturbing trend for sure. We're seeing significant polarization, I think, in American public opinion, where that trend exists on the right becoming more disturbing. And then you have this trend on the left that is becoming more promising in terms of people becoming more conscientious. I don't know what the ultimate implications are going to be for American society. I find that trend fairly disturbing, that there is this, you know, American society is being pulled apart. And it's very difficult to think of this country as a single society anymore because the extent of the political divisions is so significant. But there is no question that, you know, people who are playing on people's ignorance and promoting these ideas of extremism, this is all going to blow up in their face at the end of the day. It might be an electorally smart strategy for the Republican Party in the short term in terms of being able to win an election here or there. But in the long term, they're really leading us to a place that would not be good for the country at all and ultimately will negatively impact everyone, including the Republican establishment. And we've already seen a taste of that with Donald Trump's candidacy himself, because the Republican Party did not really favor Trump when he was running, but they've created so much hate and so much ignorance that somebody like Trump could come along and capitalize on it and win the nomination. And that is precisely what we can expect to see more of. And it's a very, very disturbing and worrying trend that we should be paying attention to.
I want to thank you, Omar Badar, for being on True Talk.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me.
احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه
هالجمال الساحرني لقيت الليل مذوبني خلاني انسى حالي
هالجمال الساحرني لقيت الليل مذوبني خلاني انسى حالي
ويلي 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 من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه
يا ويلي من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه
كل ما احس انك تعبان من عيني يطير النوم انت خلقت للفرحة ما يلبق اشوفك مهموم
كل ما احس انك تعبان من عيني يطير النوم انت خلقت للفرحة ما يلبق اشوفك مهموم
وانت لو بتروح ترخص انت اللي تأمر امر انت الحاكي من ناهي حرفك مقطع السطر
وانت لو بتروح ترخص انت اللي تأمر حرفك نقطع الصادر
ويلي 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 من الحب ويلي 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 منه يا قلبي أحضن هالقلب بحكي للدنيا عنه
ويلي بلط بحر بايع الدنيا بكرم ولا تراميها ورا الظهر واللي يعجب أهلا وسهلا والما يعجب يبلط بحر انت قلبي وانت مناي بلسمي روحي وهواي كوني كله ما يسوالي إلا وقلبك معاي ويلي 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 من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي أحضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه يا ويلي ويلي من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي أحضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا
انت لو حفنية انت حالة من الابداع كل الماضي اللي قبلك ملغي من ذكرتي ما توضع
وشك بيك اسرارك والحنية اللي بيك كل ما اشوفك بمنامي بلاقي قلبي نادي عليك
عشك بيك أسرارك والحنية اللي بيك كل ما شوفك بمنامي بلاقي قلبي نادي عليك
هالجمال انساحرني قاتلني ومتوبني خلاني انسى حالي
ويلي 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 من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي أحضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا
ويلي 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 من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه
يا ويلي ويلي من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا عنه
واللي ما ملاقي نصيبه ما يعتب على الحياة الشمس بتشرق ورا
ايوه اللي ما ملاقي نصيب ما يعتب على الحياة كل ليل كان مظلم الشمس بتشرق ورا
يا ويلي ويلي من الحب يا ويلي ويلي منه يا قلبي احضن هالقلب واحكي للدنيا
Welcome back to True Talk. We're going to shift gears now and talk about an issue that has to do with Egypt and Ethiopia. There is a Nile dispute that has been going on for several years. Ethiopia has been building a new hydroelectric dam that's promising to revive the economy and bring electricity to millions of people in mostly rural areas. But the Grand Renaissance Dam, and this is the name of the dam, the Grand Renaissance Dam, has its critics, but mainly in Egypt. Egypt says that its water supply is in danger and its people depend on that flow of for consumption and farming. In the past, the two countries have made threats about military action, but so far, nothing has happened. There are talks that sometimes are very tense and sometimes are quite diplomatic, And they are trying to reach an agreement over sharing the Nile's waters. So what is exactly going on? Why is the tension? Why is Egypt so afraid? There is an interesting short segment that was produced by Al Jazeera English, and it's by a show called Start Here, and it explains one of the most important disputes in Africa at the moment. Listen to what's behind the Egypt-Ethiopia-Nile dispute.
Let's talk about the Nile River and why Egypt and Ethiopia have been fighting over it. The problem is this dam being built in Ethiopia. Once it's finished, it'll be the most powerful hydroelectric dam in Africa. But Egypt says its supply of water is in danger of drying up. After years of talks, they're now saying they're close to signing a deal on how to share the water. But there are lots of details that need to be worked out. So why has it been so hard to end the battle for the Nile? Its official name is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and it's huge. When they're done building it, the reservoir will be bigger than Greater London and cover almost 1,700 square kilometers.
It's pretty much the largest project the government has ever embarked upon. The original cost of it was around $5 billion. It will probably be significantly more than that.
But before we get into the dispute about the dam itself, it helps to understand the Nile Basin and what's at stake. 11 African countries are in it, and 280 million people live there. The Nile is also, fun fact, the only major river that runs south to north. One of the river's tributaries, the Blue Nile, starts off in Lake Tana in Ethiopia and converges with the White Nile in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. From there, the Nile flows downstream to Egypt. There are several dams along the way, including Egypt's Aswan Dam. But Ethiopia is building its power plant upstream, right here on the border with Sudan. Now, as the name Renaissance suggests, this dam is supposed to revive Ethiopia's economy. It'll provide electricity to millions of Ethiopians. And that's big, because right now more than two-thirds of the population aren't connected to the grid. That's about 75 million people.
Over several years, it will produce 6,000 megawatts. Ethiopia's current generating capacity is only 4,000 megawatts.
So this dam is also going to generate more power for Ethiopia than it needs, meaning it can export electricity. That's all very good news for Ethiopia. But if you ask Egypt, this dam will be catastrophic. The Nile has been at the center of Egyptian life for millennia. An entire ancient civilization was built around it and relied on the river for transport and irrigation. And that's still the case today. The country relies on the Nile for almost all of its water.
It's a rain-starved, largely desert country. So obviously, any potential interruptions to the flow of the Nile is justifiably of huge concern for Egypt.
Egypt controls most of the flow of the River Nile into its country, at least for now.
Egypt's biggest worry is how quickly Ethiopia will fill the reservoir. And our colleagues at Al Jazeera Labs have studied a few scenarios. Say Ethiopia agrees to fill the reservoir over the next 10 years. AJ Labs says that would cut Egypt's water supply by 14% and destroy 18% of its farmland. If Ethiopia fills the dam more quickly, say over 7 years, one-third of Egypt's farmland would be lost. And a five-year window would destroy half of that land. According to their simulations, this is how the Egyptian delta would change over those 10 years. So Ethiopia's best case scenario, filling the dam as soon as possible, is Egypt's worst nightmare. It's no wonder these negotiations have been tough. It was during the Arab Spring in 2011, while Egypt had a revolution on its hands, that Ethiopia started building the dam. Ever since then, Egyptian leaders have tried to stop the project, and military conflict never seemed far.
Last year, Ethiopia accused Egypt of sending rebels to neighboring Eritrea to sabotage the dam, prompting another Nile-sharing country, Sudan, to send its troops to its border.
In 2018, the operating manager of the Ethiopian dam, Semenyu Bekele, was found dead.
Bekele's sudden death drew crowds and raised suspicions.
It was reported he'd been shot in broad daylight, which led to protests. But in the end, the authorities said Bekele took his own life. In 2019, Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, even said no force could stop Ethiopia from building a dam. If there's a need to go to war, we could get millions readied. If some could fire a missile, others could use bombs. This is ultimately an age-old debate about who owns the Nile. In 1929, Egypt signed a treaty with Britain, a colonial power in Africa at the time, that basically guarantees its access to the Nile and gave Egypt a veto over construction projects on the river. But Ethiopia didn't sign that treaty. Then in 1999, all the Nile Basin countries, including Egypt and Ethiopia, signed an agreement on managing water. But that deal was compromised in 2010, when six of those countries decided to draw up another treaty. This time, Egypt rejected it because it threatened its historic rights to water.
Egypt's concern that if it moves into a new treaty governing the Nile Basin, then it will be left short of water resources, and also its control over the situation will be massively reduced.
And as far as Sudan goes, it's sort of caught in the middle. Egypt is Sudan's political ally, but the government supports the Renaissance Dam because it'll be a source of affordable energy and it will help regulate flooding. The good news is that Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan are in talks with one another. The bad news is that they still haven't answered the tough questions. Questions like, when there's a drought, will Ethiopia consider Egypt's needs? And when is a drought? Those conversations will only get tougher because more dams are being planned, populations are growing, and the climate is changing, all of which will make the Nile and the supply of water increasingly worth fighting over.
Welcome back to True Talk. This wraps our show. I'm going to be interviewing American Palestinian authors. Let me give you the names of the books. So it would be wonderful if you read them before I talk to these women on True Talk. The first one is called A Woman Is No Man by Etaf Ram. Etaf is E-T-A-F, last name Ram, R-U-M. The second book I want to discuss is called Against the Loveless World. This is by Suzanne Abulhawa. Susan Abulhawa, last name A-B-U-L-H-A-W-A. She also wrote two other novels, Mornings in Jenin, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So two different novels. Her latest novel is Against the Loveless World. And then I'm going to talk to Zaina Arafat. Zaina is Z-A-I-N-A. Last name is Arafat, A-R-A-F-A-T. And the book is called You Exist Too Much. It would be wonderful if you get a chance to read these books or listen to them, because most of them are available as Audible. And it would be lovely if you can listen or read these novels before I talk to these Palestinian American women. One of the books, A Woman Is No Man, is about a Palestinian family who is in Brooklyn, and how the women who get into the family through marriage deal with, like, for instance, with A Woman Is No Man, the girl is grew up in the West Bank, and then she comes to Brooklyn, and she's, boom, married to a Palestinian young man who grew up in Brooklyn. You Exist Too Much is about a Palestinian American. The story is about a Palestinian American bisexual girl, which is a very interesting topic, actually. And then, of course, Suzanne Abulhawa talks about Palestinians being in Jenin. It's a city in the West Bank. The Blue Between Sky and Water is a girl going to Gaza. And Against the Loveless World, honestly, I have not read it yet, so I have no clue what is it about. Thank you so much for supporting WMNF, and thank you so much for supporting True Talk, and for helping us reach our goal. Let me remind you that you are listening to WMNF Tampa, and NPR News is next.